I left Albany in 2010, I had become absolutely fascinated with the fiscal problems that were affecting cities and states around the country. I was obviously intimately familiar with the problems that New York State faced, and I was interested as to whether or not New York was unique in that regard, and I found out it wasn't. And that led, to make a long story short, to my dear friend and office mate, Paul Volcker, and I creating something called the State Fiscal Crisis Task Force. And we have spent a few years studying the issues, the fiscal issues that cities and states face in this country. We are continuing that under a different rubric. So the subject fascinates me. And at the same time that I got absorbed with that as sort of a post-government occupation, a publisher asked me if I would write my autobiography. And at first I said no, and then I thought it would be interesting that nobody has really told the stories of what happened to UDC and the city of New York back in the 70s, and the fact that nobody's really paying much attention to that experience. It's as if we learned no lessons from that. And what we did to get into trouble in the 70s, we're repeating all over the country. And that's the reason I wrote the book, and that's the main purpose of the book.
You seem to relish going into troubled fiscal situations and trying to clean them up. That's something most people would rather avoid. Why do you enjoy that kind of work?
Oh, my grandson says I'm a total masochist. I have to tell you, like so many things in life, it's somewhat serendipitous. I was enjoying my business life and my family life enormously, and no complaints when out of the clear blue sky in January of 1975, Governor Carey, just having taken office, asked me to try to save the New York State Urban Development Corporation from bankruptcy. And it was the most, I was able to use my legal training, my knowledge of finance, my knowledge of housing, which had been my business, and it was the most exciting, rewarding experience of my life. And then that led to my helping the governor through the city fiscal crisis. And then a couple of years later, he asked me to chair the MTA. And that was another big challenge. And I sold my business and ran the MTA for a number of years and have since had a life of a mixture of private and things in public service.
You'll be speaking at Albany Law on the fiscal challenges facing local governments. Now, Governor Cuomo has been driving home the point. These local governments are proliferating. They've got the highest property taxes in the nation. They have to consolidate. They've got to reduce the size. But at the same time, these towns and cities are saying, you've got to give us mandate relief. Is the truth someplace in the middle there?
No, well, they're both true. They're not incompatible. They desperately need mandate relief. You have to understand that fiscal stress rolls downhill. And that's really the gravamen of the speech I'm going to give at Albany Law School. So that states get, federal aid gets cut, states' budgets are affected by that. One of the ways states address their own fiscal crises is by cutting aid to cities and local governments, so they get hurt. The political system throughout this country, including New York, has been willing to patch this over by creating short-term solutions that do nothing but kick the can down the road. That means that the next generation is going to have to pay for a lot of benefits that our generation enjoyed, and that's not good public policy.
You were the lieutenant governor from 2009 to 2010. Looking back, one person once famously said of being vice president, it's not worth a bucket of warm spit, and that's kind of cleaning it up a bit. Looking at lieutenant governor's job, how do you define it? How would you like to improve it? And just your memories of it.
I can only say this, that it was not the most rewarding, personally rewarding experience in my life. I tried to be helpful. Lieutenant governors don't have any real responsibility. I was able to hopefully help the governor on occasion when he asked on tasks. I did make recommendations on how to change the budget process, which were not accepted by the governor or the Senate. Actually, the assembly was quite interested in them. I think it's intrinsic to our constitutional system that the individual who would succeed if a governor or a president passed away during their term, that the person who would succeed them be an elected person. In my case, that issue was debated in the courts, and as you probably recall, in a 4-3 decision, the Court of Appeals said that New York State could, the governor could appoint a lieutenant governor under those circumstances. But nobody argues with the proposition that it should ideally be filled by somebody who's elected, and it's not an important job in the system of government.
From what I understand, there was a point in your tenure as lieutenant governor that you thought you may become governor. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, I never thought that. I've known David Patterson and his father, who tragically passed away last night, by the way. I've known David Patterson for years, and I had no doubt David was going to remain healthy and in office. I never had a moment's expectation that I would assume the governorship.
There was some report in the paper today that there was a transition speech ready to go, or is that not the case?
That's not the case.
One more question. You mentioned early on that we're making the very same mistakes that we made back in the 70s. What are those mistakes? What are we doing over again? We don't seem to learn from history.
We're covering current operating expenses with borrowed money and with the proceeds of asset sales. That is not a sustainable fiscal practice. You do not solve today's operating costs by discounting future revenues. It's the most significant thing we did after the New York City fiscal crisis was to require the city of New York to budget in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. And New York City has never had a fiscal crisis since then, or anything close to it.
Is the answer higher taxes? A politician who makes that case probably won't win.
That has been true, but there have been many people who have campaigned on keeping taxes low, and when they've recognized the realities of a conscientious, honest budgeting like President George Bush did, agree to a tax increase at the end of his term, recognizing full well that it would not help him in his reelection effort, and it didn't. But I also tell you a marvelous story. When I was chairman of the MTA, President Carter tried to get through Congress an increase in the gas tax to help finance the public infrastructure. The Congress paid no attention to him whatsoever. Ronald Reagan became president, and he proposed a 4-cent increase in the gas tax, one penny of which was to go to mass transit. And that was the largest potential infusion of federal money into public transportation ever. And it went through the Congress like a knife through butter. And I was president or chairman of the MTA at the time, and I was at the bill signing in the White House. And our first question the president was asked was, "Mr. President, how could you support a 4-cent increase in the gas tax when you got elected on a platform of no new taxes?" And Ronald Reagan looked at the reporter and he said, "It's not a tax, it's a user charge."